Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa lava maloilele, popongi mania, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the show, it's been a year and little to no progress on Australian Solomon Islands signing that $190 million deal to expand the Pacific Nation's police force. We're in cyclone season, so what if AI could help Pacific Islanders better prepare for extreme events like storms and floods? And coral in Papua New Guinea could provide insight on the future of the world's reefs. All those stories coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois, and it is a privilege to have you join us here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Australia and Solomon Islands have made little progress on a $190 million package to expand the Pacific Nation's police force. And the high-profile initiative was announced more than a year ago. But Solomon's Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele, says the two countries still haven't signed a pact to implement the deal. Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts has been following this story. He joins us now from Canberra. Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Aggie.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Just for, you know, some of our listeners, Stephen, could you just remind us of the history here? Like, when was this assistance announced?
Yeah, this was in December last year. In fact, on the 20th of December, just before Christmas, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese put out a statement with Jeremiah Manele, the Prime Minister of Solomon Islands, saying that Australia would plough around $190 million into the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force and set up a new police training centre in Honiara as part of a package to bolster the RSIPF. Now, the main thing Australia seemed to be committing to was money to help expand the size of the RSIPF. For Solomon Islands has said for a while now that it wants a larger police force. It is, to be fair, you know, the RSIPF too small for the size of Solomon Islands, particularly given its geographic distribution. And Mr. Manele had spoken in the months before the announcement about perhaps doubling or even tripling the number of officers in the RSIPF. And Mr. Albanese's announcement seemed to go to that, basically saying, look, we'll give you the money that you need to expand your numbers, although they didn't specifically say double, and also to provide you with the capabilities that you need. And one of the things that was at the top of the list was this police training centre that they were going to establish in Solomon Islands. Mm. So it was done with a bit of hoopla. Worth noting, Mr. Manele wasn't standing next to Mr. Albanese when this was done. This was a statement put out by both leaders, but it was only announced by Mr. Albanese in the courtyard, the Prime Minister's courtyard in Parliament House. So that was the announcement. It was a while ago now, almost 12 months.
Well then, so, you know, as we said, there seems to be little or no progress, but has anything actually happened since then?
Yeah, a little bit has happened. The two prime ministers met in September this year when all leaders gathered in Honiara for the Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting. And they discussed the package then, and they also announced, or Australia also said, that the two men had announced that there had been an agreement made on essentially a design process for the police academy, as they're calling it now. So no actual sods, as far as I can turn, has been turned, but there is some sort of movement on the design of that building. We don't know yet exactly when it will actually begin physical construction, or at least no public information I can find that points to when that might happen. But there does seem to be some sort of design work underway. But as far as the ABC can tell, that's about it. Mm. Nothing more has happened, and there hasn't been any progress, as far as we can tell, on this process of expanding the numbers of their RSIPF. And it's also worth noting that at this stage, Australia and Solomon Islands are also yet to sign an MOU on the governance and implementation of this package. Mm. Now, this first obviously became bogged down back in earlier this year, perhaps around the beginning of this year, in the wake of the announcement in March. Mr. Manele made a slightly cryptic reference to a couple of, quote, differences between Australia and Solomon Islands, which prevented that agreement being signed. Last week, when he spoke to the ABC, he said that agreement still, in fact, had not been signed, saying a little bit vaguely that officials would revisit the issue, but not really giving us a timeline for when that might happen, and suggesting that the differences were still there, saying that it was because of the, quote, language in the agreement. Now, exactly what those differences are is not 100% clear. Back in March, Solomon Islands official told the ABC that Australia was trying to use this agreement to effectively block China from expanding or maintaining its policing programs in Solomon Islands. So perhaps the disagreement comes down to some of the language that might be in that broader MOU that Solomon Islands feels is a bit exclusionary. Australia, for its part, I mean, it would be no surprise if it was seeking, you know, guarantees like that. We've seen Australia sign a number of agreements, as you know, Aggie, with countries throughout the region which are explicitly designed to bolster Pacific policing cooperation and bolster Australian support, while simultaneously seeking to effectively either limit or lock out China as a security player in the Pacific.
And that's the thing. You've said, you know, one of the differences or even one of the reasons for the delay is the language in the agreement. But do you think then, Stephen, was it premature in Albanese having to announce the assistance?
Well, it definitely looks premature now because little has happened. But, you know, I guess to be fair, that they wouldn't have known that in December last year. And I'm sure both sides would have felt pretty confident in December last year they'd be able to find a way forward. I think it's also worth pointing out the differences or the delay is probably not just down to the difficulties around the language in this agreement and the fact that Australia's seemingly pushing ahead with this police academy despite the agreement not being signed shows that there's probably quite a bit of flexibility in Australia's approach, and it's probably still willing to push ahead with individual programs. Another problem might be the fact that Solomon Islands is yet to work out exactly what it wants to do with this money. Mm. So you might remember back earlier this year, Solomon Islands unveiled a new national security strategy. In the wake of that, Jeremiah Manele said that Solomon Islands felt that perhaps that $190 million wouldn't go far enough to cover all of Solomon Islands' security needs. At the same time, Pat Conroy, the Minister for the Pacific in Australia, said there was a pretty live debate inside Solomon Islands about whether that money would better be spent on expanding the numbers of police in the Solomon Islands police force, or whether it might instead be better be spent expanding things like infrastructure for police in the outer provinces. Mr. Manele has made a few references to that disagreement internally as well. So it doesn't seem to be entirely about this disagreement over the agreement, although I think that's part of it. There does seem to also be a live question or a live debate within the government of Solomon Islands as it tries to work out exactly what its key priorities are and how this money might best be spent. And the statement, brief as it is, issued by the Australian side in response to the ABC's questions seems to gesture towards that. It makes a reference to the fact that Australia is very happy to support the, quote, evolving security priorities of Solomon Islands.
Interesting. Again, yeah, you briefly just touched on the fact of this possibly could open up space, right, for China to further enhance its security partnership with Australia. I mean, yeah, what is likely to happen now?
Well, we don't know. Obviously, one of the reasons Australia wants to push ahead with this is because it wants to stop or effectively cap Chinese cooperation with the Solomon Islands in this space. Basically, the point Australia has always made to Solomons is, look, we don't see China as a proper security partner. You know, Pacific leaders have said security solutions should be Pacific-led. If there's any gap in any of your training or any of your police force capabilities, please come to us first and we will help. And this is exactly what this deal is meant to be about. But in the end, if there isn't the willingness in Solomon Islands to press ahead with this, either because of sensitivities around China or perceptions that Australia is trying to lock out China, or because of internal disagreements about the best way forward, then there's only so much the Australian, you know, government can do. I mean, the Prime Minister's answer to the ABC on this seems to suggest that there will be some sort of attempt to revivify negotiations on this and to try and find a way forward. He made a reference to pressing ahead with individual projects, even in the absence of an agreement. So perhaps we'll see more announcements like the Police Academy, with Australia still putting out all or some of this money over the coming years. But yeah, we're 3 years into what was meant to be a four-year implementation package. And as I say, because of all of this, there's been little to show for it so far.
Yeah. Stephen, look, always great to catch up. Really appreciate you keeping us across the situation.
No problem. Thanks, Aggie.
Thank you. That is Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
To Papua New Guinea's government, they've tabled a $10 billion budget with the focus on strengthening law and order. Treasurer Ian Ling Stuckey says the budget sees close to a 10% increase in government spending on keeping citizens safer. Here he is giving a budget breakdown of what's being spent on security as well as law and order.
Further investments in our police of 761 million kina, including a 34% increase in goods and services funding to cover operational costs such as fuel, and with funding for wages increasing by 19% over the last 2 years as part of supporting a growth to 10,000 police by 2030. Our judiciary receives a further 19% increase in operating costs, lifting the total funding increase since 2024 to a 59% increase in operating costs. Our defence forces receive a 29% increase in their goods and services. Our priority areas, tracking line of police field, defence catering, court cases, receives a 42% increase from 112 million to 159 million kina. Our corrective services receive a 10.6% increase in operating funding in 2026. Our Office of Public Prosecutor receives a 60% increase in operating costs over 2 years.
And Mr. Ling Stuckey says other priorities include expanding economic opportunities, boosting service delivery, and providing targeted relief to households. Prime Minister James Marape says members of the opposition have the rest of this week to scrutinise the budget before providing their response to it next Tuesday. Mr. Marape says the budget is fiscally responsible and puts PNG on the right path towards a balanced budget by 2027. Papua New Guinea's Parliament will resume next week.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Whaftai tere lava, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, disputes between landowners and developers have been identified as a major hindrance to the development of more hydropower projects in Solomon Islands. The issue was discussed at a recent meeting in Honiara organised by the Ministry of Mines, Energy and Rural Electrification and the United Nations Development Programme. One of the panellists at the meeting was Casper Fasala, Chief Executive Officer of the National Disability Forum, who says there are plenty of rivers throughout the country that could be used to generate much needed power in rural and remote areas. He tells reporter Caroline Tierman landowners need to be given more ownership and involvement in projects to get them on side with the government and developers.
Many more people will come and register their rights over the land demarcation area where rivers and streams are located in. And therefore, when we discuss issues of having hydro in the discussions that I have, it will allow more people to come forward. And because of the benefits of the lights, the small businesses that the hydro power energy will provide, people will be so willing to support such a project that certainly will give them a direct benefit right in the village.
What sort of things will people be using in terms of energy and the small SMEs?
There's a lot of things that are now on the market. When we look at drying of peanut, producing packaging, all that would be something of value to the people in the village to plant more peanuts for that matter. Cassava is now being exported. But again, if we have those kind of hydro energy and power in the village, we can increase the production of cassava farming, and then people can use such energy in terms of electricity to turn the cassava into flour, and therefore they can sell flour right from the village. Another good example would be, especially for the disabilities, especially men who has already been trained at the rural training centers, for example, the Bethesda Disability Support and Training Center, and San Isidro Ariligo Training Center, which have trained many disabilities in terms of furniture and woodwork. It will help them increase their capacity in making quality products that can be sellable both in their village and outside of the village, maybe in the towns, and that would be more competitive.
What about women's participation in small SMEs?
Women can now increase their capacity in the sewing industry, which means they can now move on from hand sewing machines to electrical sewing machines, and they can produce more clothing for the schools, uniforms, and all that for children and for the women's organizations where they need them. They can sew those clothes right in the village and therefore, again, increase their marketing and their capacity, and also will increase their skills, and training will be certainly be around those areas, which I mentioned, but right in the village, which could make it easy for them in terms of life and also increase their marketing right in the village because of the hydropower that is going to be provided by themselves. Again, they need government support to build those hydropowers, and therefore the utilization of it will benefit the communities across the board and also people from disabled to able people.
And that there is Casper Fasala, Chief Executive Officer of the National Disability Forum of Solomon Islands, speaking there with Caroline Tierman.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Nō ia e Māori, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Ball. Now, November to April is a cyclone season across the southern parts of the Pacific. But even when there's no cyclones to deal with, the region is never short of earthquakes, droughts and volcanoes. But what if AI can help Pacific Islanders better prepare for extreme events like storms and floods? Well, Solomon Islands is trialling a system called Edison, which will come online in a couple of months. That might give locals an upper hand. The system is part of UNESCO's Disaster Prevention Program and was built by SAP and Awita University in Japan. Now joining us this morning is SAP Sustainability and Commercial Officer Sophia Mendelson. With that, I say welcome, Sophia.
Well, thank you and good morning to you.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us this morning, Sophia. I mean, gosh, it's pretty exciting having to maybe combine AI and disaster prevention. Like, how does Edison work?
Yeah, it is exciting and it is important. So fundamentally, what Edison is doing is bringing together real-time meteorological data and historical records. That means we can be more precise about our disaster warnings and help those folks on the ground, the authorities, anticipate the risks before they escalate, because you want to predict beforehand and then you want better recovery after.
And how long was this in the making?
This was made in rapid response time to a real disaster, an earthquake in Japan, as you mentioned. And the number of days we stood this level of AI and technology up in is really reflective of the experience so many people, unfortunately, have in their real lives. You don't have time during a disaster. SAP built this in 10 days, and now we're working with UNESCO to get it out ahead of time so we don't have to ever see a community in that level of rush again.
Sophia, I know that the trial is going to be in the Solomon Islands, but why were Solomon Islands chosen, though?
Well, I think Solomon Islands is important for the reason so many islands are important. We know that small developing nations are a smaller contributor of carbon emissions, yet are the ones exposed first and foremost, very unfortunately, to things like sea level rise and the very real impact of day-to-day flooding in people's lives. I mean, going shopping, kids trying to get to school, this is real stuff, and we have to get as much ahead of it as we can.
I understand the AI aspect, but again, how is this really different from traditional weather and forecasting tools?
Yeah, the real difference here is the number of things we're bringing together. So it's no longer a person going through the historical records and trying to make a prediction. They're combining now those historical records with real-time data from the government, from the community, from the private sector, from things like webcams and sensors and what's called quote-unquote IoT or the Internet of Things, which are those like little sensors you might have on water pipes or air quality monitors or sea level rise or humidity. And so you can now bring together thousands of data points and compute them automatically for a prediction in seconds and minutes versus a person taking years, which we unfortunately no longer have time for.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask, will it actually make, you know, everyday weather forecasts that more accurate?
Yeah. I mean, what we're really wanting to do is not predict the day-to-day weather forecast, but really forecast damage to a landscape that could happen from a natural disaster, and then make recommendations on where to dispatch emergency services and gives insight into issuing evacuation orders. And that part about making recommendations and giving insight is the important part. You don't want to just collect data. You want to actually do something with it, have a point of view, and transfer that point of view to the folks in charge on the ground.
Sophia, any sort of challenges or limitations, though, that it may come with?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of data available when a disaster hits, and you need it in real time. But data in a disaster zone is by definition behind a physical block of fire, of water, of mud. So, for example, in Japan, when there was this huge earthquake, very unfortunately, in the Noto Peninsula, there were 14,000 people displaced in official and unofficial sites. Those are not folks who have a cell phone in their hands, top of mind, ready to transfer data to an official. Instead, the AI solution did that work for them and brought together data from a range of sources, right, to understand how each evacuee individually in each of these thousands of locations was living, so the authorities could get them the right amount of aid, medicine, food, and water, because those aren't things that are in abundance during a disaster time, and you want to be able to distributing them right in the right times.
Let's sort of look maybe at a scenario, you know, like what happens if there is a power cut? Like, does it still work? Like, what are the redundancies maybe?
Yeah, sure. This is an AI and technology that's sitting on a laptop in a disaster zone, right? It would sit with a centralized preparation authority or someone in a zone that's separate from where the disaster is, and then be sharing that information out to first responders through things like cell phones.
Can I ask, Sophia, you know, this is obviously a blueprint, right, for maybe other small island developing states. Yeah, how has the response been? Like, have you already gone out to the rest of the Pacific to say, hey, this is what we've got going on?
No, so this developed in Japan, just getting started. The vision really is that Edison is easy to scale up and down, right? It has a modular design. So we want it to be able to grow alongside a nation's needs. So a government can use a sophisticated disaster management tool without requiring extensive budget or technical expertise.
How has the response been from the Solomon Islands? They must be excited to see this come to their country.
Well, I hope so, but the proof is in the pudding and the work is ahead of us. What SAP does so well is pair the data and the people together. Nothing is solved by AI alone, and people can't solve problems without data. It's bringing those things together in a tool, but also in a community.
Yeah, of course. So that's the thing. How will everyday Solomon Islanders benefit from this AI system?
Yeah, so if in the unfortunate incident, there is a disaster, what we would do is bring together data in real time so that your local authorities had early warning capabilities first and then help in recovery after.
It's definitely something I think most of our islands will definitely benefit from once it's implemented. Sophia, was there any message that you wanted to share with our listeners this morning before the program actually comes out?
Yeah, we want to make sure AI is being used for more than predicting the next sentence, creating a picture, or doing a little shopping, right? AI can forecast damage that could come to a landscape. It can make recommendations on where to dispatch emergency services and give insight to issuing evacuation orders. That's the highest level of application of AI.
Great to talk with you, Sophia, this morning. Really appreciate you giving us a little bit of insight into this new system that hopefully will benefit, of course, our people there in the Solomon Islands.
And thank you. And thank you to your listeners for their time.
Absolutely. That is SAP Sustainability and Commercial Officer Sophia Mendelson here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nesia Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nesia Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, the president of the PNG Kickboxing Federation, Stanley Nandick, says getting visas for his fighters to compete in Australia is stressful and saps energy ahead of events. Nandick's a former world champion, known as the Headhunter in his glory days, is trying to send a group of young fighters to Sydney for two events, the first of which is this Friday, but they're still waiting for visas. He says it would be helpful if Australian authorities could issue visas to athletes that would allow multiple entries and be valid for longer than 3 months. Stanley Nandick is speaking to reporter Godwin Eke.
If so, December is the big one where we have almost 3 title fights will be on the card. Mark Sondo, Nelson Samson, and Kundup Samson will be also fighting for the title fights. I think these guys here have been really, really prepared. I might be taking them this week. We're just waiting for the visas and hoping that it should arrive today. As soon as when it arrives today, I think we'll be departing tomorrow. Also together with the rest of the team, because they need to also prepare themselves in Sydney prior to the event. So I think it's all looking good. We've got some support game from the National Youth Development Authority, and I guess I think the officials, two of the officials, will be also accompanying us with the rest of the team. So we are looking forward for their support, and we are looking forward for the event as well.
This is not the first time you and your team has had, you know, delays when it comes to visa to Australia. Any specific reasons as to why these delays have been encountered, you know, during the application process?
sort of on and off. The other time they issued a ticket, this is, let's say, 2-3 days before we applied. This is like taking a week and a half now. And so normally it takes a week for a visa process. And actually, it has been exceeded that, depending on the information. But I think with the information that we are providing is genuine and it's straightforward, the sports visa. And we are not allowed to stay longer than that when the visas are granted. And we know that most of the fighters, they traveled 2-3 times and they haven't got any issues, but it's just that they're not giving us long kind of visas that we can able to last for a year or two. You know, sometimes when they only give us a 3 months, it's very limited once that is over, and then we have another invitations, and this whole process just continues again. So that is the whole thing, and we've been coming on the air very strongly emphasizing on this to, you know, treat us differently. But if it's just a system that is, if they have their own system of handling this such a situation, then we can't say or comment much on that. But as far as our preparations are going, I think we are ready, and as soon as when this comes on, and we'll be on board.
But has it affected, you know, delays, especially has it affected preparations for the tournament? And also, are you worried you might miss the competitions, or if anything like this happens? Of course, it does affect events in future.
Of course, they're correct. You're correct with that. And that situation, you know, when you're looking at focusing much on those important things, like your preparations and things, and then in between, when you have these visa issues, that is no guarantee, and you having this so much of stress trying to go around and waiting for when is they going to grant these visas. And of course, it absorbs so much of our energy, but you know, we just praying that hope things all come on in time so these guys can really, you know, take time, because they've been really preparing for this event since after the September show. So this is one of the event that is going to be also and you know, all our program for this year, and we want to, you know, come up with a good news and a good performance out there on international stage. So that is where our focus is at the moment. I think this is going to be the biggest event for at least 2-3 times. I mean, 3 different titles in the different weight divisions. We haven't had this in a very long time, and it is, you know, an opportunity for the country and also the fighters for them to put their position in the international level to be recognized, and so that they're able to, you know, have any invitations around the world. And and for the country, we want to really see if PNG can really place top in the world in terms of other sports. If other sports may have their own strength, why can't kickboxing become one of the, you know, sports that it can do well in on an international level? So, you know, all these kind of feelings about, you know, trying to represent to the best in for the country and so that's happening around, and the feeling is good. It's just that matter of waiting for the visa. So if that happens, then I think we should be good.
And that's the president of the PNG Kickboxing Federation, Stanley Nandix, talking to Godwin Ecky. Scientists say new research on coral in Papua New Guinea could provide an insight on the future of the world's reefs. And its findings are worrying, with increased levels of carbon dioxide in the ocean expected to change ocean chemistry, devastating reefs and creating more algae. The study by the Australian Institute of Marine Science focuses on the volcanic reefs of Milne Bay. Its lead researcher is Dr. Katerina Fabricius. She joins us on the line from Queensland. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Doctor.
Good morning.
As we get straight into this, why was Milne Bay chosen for this specific study? Like, what makes it so unique?
Yeah, so I discovered these bubbles of carbon dioxide that they're coming out of the seafloor in Milne Bay almost a quarter of a century ago in 2000, while I was doing biodiversity surveys of the beautiful coral reefs of Milne Bay. And at that time, ocean acidification was not an issue. Scientists didn't know about it. But when it started being taken serious in a concern, I remembered that I saw all these streams of bubble coming out of the seafloor. And we mounted an expedition, and together with the local communities, we were able to then access 3 different volcanic sites. Basically, the carbon dioxide from the volcanoes is simulating what will happen to our coral reefs as the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations are increasing.
Yeah, was this sort of the first time that you had ever witnessed something like this?
Yeah, totally. It's globally unique site. The carbon dioxide, it's a very clean site. It's a very healthy coral reef. It's a lovely communities living around that area. And people have started looking for comparable sites all around the world, but Milne Bay is still by far the leading place where we can do this kind of research.
Now, some of us may be quite familiar with ocean acidification. We know that it's been happening across parts of the Pacific, and Australia. What did this study actually sort of add to scientific knowledge? Was there anything new?
Yeah, we learned lots from that site. In particular, what we wanted to know is what is going to happen when, because ocean acidification is happening already today, but it's an ongoing process. And what we learned from those sites is that by looking at areas with different CO2 exposure, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, how the communities are changing along those gradients. And what we found is there are no particular tipping points. There's not a place where coral reefs cease to exist. But the more CO2 is in the water, the worse it gets for our coral reef communities. We're losing diversity. The fleshy algae are increasing in abundance. And we are losing the capacity of the reefs to recover from disturbances because the little baby corals just don't like it there. So we don't get recovery after bleaching and storm disturbances.
Doctor, is there sort of then maybe, you know, much hope for the Pacific Ocean? I mean, are you saying all corals are likely to be affected by acidification?
No, and that's the good news from that story. So there are a wide range of sensitivities. There are some corals that are quite tough and will exist with no problems throughout the century, whereas others are disappearing more quickly. So we are only looking at ocean acidification in this context. Heat stress is obviously an additional problem that we did not study. Other people have looked at that often, but coral reefs are incredibly resilient in many ways. So we are hoping that some kind of coral reefs will continue to exist, but they will just look very different. And unfortunately, there won't be the same complexity in structure and form that is so important as habitat for all the organisms that are living on coral reefs and that we are liking to use for food. So things like shrimps and crabs and all these little things that are hiding in coral reefs don't find so easily a home if those branching corals are missing.
You touched a little bit, you know, around fleshy algae. I know that's one of the findings, and that was the growth in that. Just for our listeners, can you explain what this means for marine life and animals?
Yeah, so algae are plants like on land, but they're using the CO2 for photosynthesis, so they're benefiting from the higher CO2. Whereas corals are building a skeleton made out of basically limestone, and limestone and acid just don't go together, as we know from betel nut and also. So we are basically predicting that corals are struggling and the algae are proliferating, which means that coastal protection from coral reefs is less likely to be as effective as it is today because coral reefs won't be growing as fast and they won't be providing the same habitat for all the protein and livelihoods that we are getting from coral reefs.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
So, I mean, basically, the bottom line is the earlier we are, and we as the Western nations, stopping emitting carbon dioxide, the better it is for the coral reefs.
What then is the impact, you know, for our Pacific communities, for those especially who rely, you know, on the sea for food and their livelihoods from the ocean?
Yeah, totally. Unfortunately, coral reefs are one of the most sensitive marine communities to the first ones to suffer from the increasing CO2 emissions. The outlook, there are regional differences, and we don't understand ocean acidification all that well as yet. We don't understand where there are the refuges, where are there additional mechanisms for reefs to cope. So in this case, we just looked at one particular coral reef and looked at relative sensitivities of different organisms. But what we have not got at this stage is a good overview over the spatial patterns throughout the Pacific of which areas are faring better and which are more vulnerable. Mm. But you're right. I mean, a lot of people are depending on coral reefs for their livelihoods and for the protein, for food. And for coastal shelter, I mean, inundation and so on. So now my call to action really is to the more CO2 emissions we avoid, the better it is.
If you've just joined us, I'm joined by lead researcher Dr. Katerina Frobitius. She's joining us from the line on Queensland about this whole increased levels of carbon dioxide in the ocean that's expected to change ocean chemistry and, of course, could possibly devastate reefs and create more algae. Doctor, it's like a chain reaction, right, isn't it? If carbon dioxide absorption and acidification is unchecked, what then again will happen to the ocean?
It's a global issue. Like, we do have reefs in warmer waters and in cooler waters. Organisms can move to some extent to cooler regions and acclimatize there. For ocean acidification, unfortunately, there's no real escape. And because it's a global issue, it's what's in the atmosphere goes into the ocean, and it's affecting the whole food webs. It's affecting the plankton in the water. It's affecting fish behavior. And it really is a very pervasive type of pollution that we still not fully understand what all the consequences are.
Yeah, I know, again, this is quite a technical and scientific topic. But again, what's your message to our audience listening in from across the Pacific? You know, like, what key thing would you want them to know?
The main issue is that reefs are under increasing pressure. So what we can do locally in order to reduce pressure, such as preventing the runoff of sediments, the overfishing, destructive fishing, all helps the reefs to fare with all these new and additional challenges. So we can do a lot of stuff locally, maintaining vegetation cover along the shore, preventing big silt plumes coming down our rivers. And so water quality is increasing in importance, and that is an area where we can work on locally. And same with overfishing. Having marine protected areas and healthy fish populations keeps those algae down, those pesky algae that compete with the corals and that are benefiting from the higher CO2. So having healthy marine protected areas, having a good water quality is probably the best we can do at this stage to help our coral reefs.
Doctor, as we wrap up, where can people go for more information on this?
There is some information at the website of the Australian Institute of Marine Science. So if you enter that title of our organization, together with ocean acidification, you come to a website we put together to find additional information.
Nice. Doctor, really appreciate your time and sharing with us this morning. It's been fascinating to listen to the work that you are doing.
Thanks very much for your interest. Have a good day.
No worries. That is Dr. Katerina Frobitius from the Australian Institute of Marine Science. Manolele and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it's that time we head around the region and get our headlines. And joining me this morning is producer Whenau Whanua Whewhe.
So bear.
Well, look, I know we sort of left this late, but, you know, we're getting there and we've got some stories from around the region. The first one here is Papua New Guinea government has signed a major economic deal with China. Can you tell us more?
Yes, Papua New Guinea's government has signed a bilateral document on the Belt and Road Corporation, but no actual details of this deal have been revealed. We're expecting PNG's government to confirm what the document agrees on. What we do know is the Chinese ambassador in Port Moresby, Yang Zhao Guang, said that PNG is China's largest trading partner in the region, primary development partner. Last year, bilateral trade exceeded more than 17 billion kina. That's the equivalent of 6.5 million Australian dollars. Wow. Direct flights between China and Port Moresby have increased to 3 per week. And according to the Chinese embassy, China has provided grants and concessional loans to PNG, implementing more than 60 projects.
Wow.
Focusing on infrastructure, education, agriculture, and public health.
Here we go. Okay, to Vanuatu, though, specialised training is underway in Port Vila to prepare Vanuatu for future local production of anti-pest fungi. This is interesting. What is this fungi?
Yes, this fungi, it's called Metahysium, and it's used to kill the coconut rhinoceros beetle, which is a pest that damages copra. Copra is a major export for Vanuatu. Last year, it generated more than $2 million. 1,500 tons of copra were exported from Vanuatu. So, they want to produce this locally for quality control reduce the loss of copra.
Okay, nice. We want to go back to PNG, though, if you know, because a former governor will stand trial for corruption. What's the details of this scandal?
So former governor for Jiwaka province, William Tongap, will stand trial in Papua New Guinea's National Court for misappropriating more than 1 million kina, that's equivalent of 370,000 Australian dollars. This was of public funds from 2013 to 2019. So Tongap has been charged with one count of abuse of office, 16 counts of misappropriation. And police say they have the financial documents relating to these allegations, which they seized during a search warrant and confirmed with a local bank that he made payments through this. But these are the allegations against Tongap. Corruption, a big problem in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, well, across the Pacific is usually what we are reporting on. Very unfortunate on that case. But as always, though, thank you very much, Finel, for coming through and bringing us our latest headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Australia and Solomon Islands have made little progress on a $190 million package to expand the Pacific Nations police force.
There hasn't been any progress of expanding the numbers of their RSIPF. At this stage, Australia and Solomon Islands are also yet to sign an MOU on the implementation of this package.
Find that story when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. Remember, you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisa Daily. So until next time, o tua o whātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.